the host who laughs at all my bad jokes. This is Sanjana Needs a Friend.
Welcome back to the show, everyone. Dave has an apology to make.
Yes, I realized that in a previous podcast episode, I threw some shade at Fred Van Vliet and the Toronto Raptors. And since then, I've had to eat my words because he set a franchise record with 54 points recently. So, Fred, I'm sorry. I hope to make it up to you next time I see you. Perhaps courtside seats? No? No. Okay. Well, go Raps, go.
Wait, you think he should give you courtside seats for your apology to him?
I never said that it made sense.
Right.
Or that I make sense, but guys gotta hope.
Want the courtside seats. I'm just really excited that Fred Van Vliet has decided to join InterVarsity staff.
You know what? If he did, Nathan Thompson would absolutely lose it. He would really just lose it. Nathan Thompson loves the Raptors.
Oh, I was thinking he loved Fred Van Vliet specifically. Vliethead, that one.
I think everyone listening to this podcast should email Nathan Thompson. That's nthompson@ivcf.ca. With just a simple question. Raptors or Van Vliet or both?
Yeah, okay.
So, I mean, that's a simple way of getting to know some people in InterVarsity. Just send them just random emails like that.
You could just type in like two letters into your two bar on the email and just see what pops up. And then just click that name and that email. Just be like, you know, SM. Do we have anybody whose first name starts with an S and whose last name starts with an M?
If Sherry Gothy was Sherry Mothy, then yes, but no. I'm ridiculous.
Yes, if someone's name was completely different. Okay, but you know what I mean. Just type in two random letters and then you get a random email.
Uh-huh.
Just send them. And then every time the question is the same. Van Vliet or the Raptors or both.
I like that.
Yeah.
I like that. Maybe we can also, we could enter NP, get Nigel Pollock in there. But don't ask him. Ask him to ask Elsa.
Ooh.
What her thoughts are.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that would be good. I
feel like Ailsa is an equal opportunist.
I think you're probably right.
Over Van Vliet alone. Mm-hmm.
Well, as a way of getting to know us, because we're the ones who are on this podcast, I thought we could play a little game I like to call Two Truths and a Lie, copyright 2021. Never happened before. That's copyright Dave's Winstone.
It's Dave's first lie of the round.
Yeah. So I will go first. I can do that. No problem. Okay. So here are the three statements. One, when I was 11 years old, I was apprehended by the RCMP for breaking into the Senate on Parliament Hill.
Okay.
Number two, my apartment in second year university was infiltrated by a SWAT team that thought there was an active shooter in my apartment.
Okay.
Statement three. I was taken to the police station in the back of a police car and questioned under suspicion of being a drug trafficker in my third year of university.
You know, I've heard a lot of your stories over the years, so I'm like really trying to dig back into the memory banks here and figure out which of those sounds not true, because knowing you, they're all entirely possible.
Sad, but true.
Yeah. Okay, so the first one, you said you were 12?
I was 11.
11, and you broke into the Senate, and the RCMP escorted you home?
Well, I was apprehended by the RCMP.
Okay.
And like, I never lived in Ottawa. I was just
right. Yeah, because you lived in Brantford.
Yeah.
So this was like a, this was a school trip or this was a family trip?
This was a family trip.
Yeah.
To Ottawa.
Okay. Okay.
October of 95.
Around 95?
Yeah, October 95.
Okay. Okay, the second one, a SWAT team invaded your apartment in fourth year.
And then second year.
In second year. And then the third one was that you were suspected of being a drug trafficker in your third year.
Yes.
Okay, I think the first one is true. I think the second one is true. I think the third one is a lie.
The third one is true. I went to report a drug trafficker, but they thought I was actually the drug trafficker because of the way I dressed.
Because of the way you dressed.
Yeah, yes. Number two is true. A SWAT team did infiltrate my apartment under suspicion of a active shooter. And my housemate had the red, like, dots on his chest.
I think I've heard that story before. Yeah.
So that's true.
Which is why I knew that one was true.
The lie is that I broke into the Senate. What's true is I accidentally broke into the House of Commons while it was in session behind the speaker's chair. And as an 11-year-old heard, intruder in the house, intruder in the house. And whoops. Yeah.
Wow.
I cried and I told my parents I wanted to go back to Brantford the next day.
Yeah. First time those words have ever been spoken.
Yeah.
Wow.
I've lived a wild, crazy life. So, Sanjana, what are your two truths and a lie?
Okay, so I am quite adept at hitting my head. So I'm going to tell you three times that that might have happened. And you tell me which one did not happen. Okay, so the first time I went snowboarding, I caught a bad edge, flung myself down the mountain, got whiplash and a concussion, and proceeded to continue snowboarding for the whole rest of the day. So that's one. Number two. I was visiting Vancouver, went hiking with a friend. We came to this like kind of beachy area and then decided that we were going to climb this big log that kind of looked a little bit driftwoody. It was a bit slick. And there was another group of people. My friend got up on the log really easily and I, for some reason, struggled. And then I slipped and cracked the bottom of my head on this like bit that was sticking out of the log, this like really sharp little bit. Blacked out for a few seconds, but was so embarrassed that when I came to, I just started laughing hysterically, like everything was fine. Number three, I've done swing dancing on and off over the years and was doing swing dancing around the end of university, was partnered with this guy that I hadn't really danced with very much, but we'd been partnered up a few times over the last few weeks and got really ambitious and decided to try a flip. We did one and it was great. The next song came on. We did another and he dropped me on my head. But again, was really embarrassed. So I just got up and continued.
Okay, I'm gonna say that the first one is a lie, only because maybe I've been duped by you, but that story had the least amount of detail. So is the first one the lie?
No, the first one is true.
Ooh.
I did get a concussion my first time snowboarding and just continued to board for the rest of the day. It was like, wow. There was one time where I was going up on the chair and I thought to myself, wow, it's a really bright day today, which if you know anything about the East Coast, was clearly wrong. It's never a bright day on the East Coast, except for today, actually, miraculously. The second one was also true. The third one was a lie. That didn't happen to me, but it actually did happen to a friend of mine. She did get dropped on her head while swing dancing. And actually, that was really sad because she's like never really been the same since. It was actually a really major concussion. All of mine were really, really minor concussions. Hers was like a really major concussion. So,
I'm yeah. sorry. Did you just use the painful story of a friend?
I did.
That's your lie.
I did. And that wow. doesn't tell you something about me.
Oh my gosh. My opinion of you has changed.
Mm.
Oh, just for the next few seconds, I'm sure it will go away.
Yeah.
Well, okay. So I think everyone now has very odd pictures of who we are. So that being said, I think yeah. we should transition to the meat and potatoes of this podcast and get the focus off of us and onto our wonderful guests. So what are we talking about today?
Well, we're talking about hospitality. How do we invite people into spaces where they feel welcome and help them to integrate with our communities? And hospitality feels like a weird thing to talk about in a COVID season because we can't do any of the things that we, you know, used to be able to do. But we'll talk about that a little bit in this episode of the podcast. Yeah, it's also, I think, important that we talk about hospitality now in the midst of COVID, because our mandate hasn't changed and the things that we're about haven't actually changed. We just have to find more creative ways to do it, to be about it. So we're going to learn from some people today about how to be hospitable in all circumstances.
Great. Looking forward to it.
Okay. Let's go make some friends.
Okay. Hi, I'm Tony. I'm in Toronto, in Ontario, at the U of T. I work with international students. And why should I be Sanjana's friend? Well, I could feed her.
Hi, I'm Sherilyn Post from Ottawa, Ontario, and I work with international students at the University of Ottawa and also St. Paul University. And I'm so pleased to be Sanjana's friend.
I'm Sharon Stewart, and we are at Pioneer Camp Manitoba, and we do lots of different things around food. I'm specifically working with the food service, managing the food service team that we have, and other assorted programs. And I look forward to being Sanjana's friend. I don't know her well enough yet.
My name is Neil Stewart. We spend half our year in Winnipeg and half our year out on Shoal Lake, Ontario. I work as one of the directors at Manitoba Pioneer Camp, and we serve kids from 6 to adults. And I'm just excited to be Sanjana's friend.
I live on the East Coast, right? I don't know if you knew that. I'm in Halifax, and basically all of the Atlantic provinces are just giant granite rocks. So in other provinces, you might bury cables so that the weather, inclement weather, doesn't affect them too badly. We can't do that here because you have to blast every time you want to dig. So all of our cables are above ground, hanging in the trees. And if there is a slight breeze, my internet might go down. It happens all the time. And likely through the course of this call, the quality of my internet will degrade. So you might be in the country, but I'm on the coast and my internet still sucks. So
I'm more intrigued. Did you say you bury the cable?
Yeah. What do you say, Dave?
A bury.
You bury them?
a bury them in the garage.
In the what?
Oh, man. Vancouver's so weird with their garages.
Garage, yeah.
The garage. Oh.
I think, Tony, do you say garage?
Depends who I'm with.
Okay.
Nice answer.
Garage or garage?
Yeah.
I'm bilingual. I speak both Canadian and British English.
Yeah.
Nice.
That's still better than garage.
I just want to hear you say, oh yeah, eh, at some point in this conversation. That will prove your fluency to me.
In Canadian English?
Yeah. Oh yeah, new do the boot it. Oh yeah, eh?
Well, thanks for joining us, everyone. I am excited to get to know my new friends on this podcast, particularly because today we're talking about food and hospitality. And food is probably one of my favorite things in the world. My roommate made a whole bunch of borscht the other day. So I just had like a big bowl of borscht for lunch, and now my room smells like borscht, which is really nice while you're eating it and is really irritating after you're done. But yeah, I love food, and I feel like you all have very also deep loves for food, and I'm excited to see where this goes. And I'd like to learn more about hospitality, because I don't know that I'm like the most hospitable person, but I feel like you all very much are. So maybe we can start with just like some defining. What is hospitality to you? What does that encompass when you think about it? Obviously, to me, the key part of it is eating, but I feel like that's a pretty reductionist definition of hospitality. So maybe you can help me flesh that out a bit.
Where we learned our hospitality rather than what it is, because that helps the context and also what it is. I learned my hospitality from my mom, my parents, and also from people in the UK, because when you're a stranger in a country, I grew up there, but my family wasn't British. Hospitality is somewhere to go which isn't your home.
Yeah, I grew up in Texas where we were very open. We used to have large parties at our house, and then as I grew up, we used to visit restaurants a lot because our family party sizes got so big that we would, it was just so much easier to have someone else cook all the food for you. And so I grew up in that, and then I moved to Canada, and I really refined my hospitality working with the Fairmont hotel chain, where they really just teach you that hospitality is thinking about the people who are coming before they get there and being ready to serve them and like exceed their expectations. And so that's a big part of, in my mind, just that you've thought of somebody before they get there and that you've tried to make it something that
caring for and anticipating people's needs, whether they know they have those needs or desires or not.
We talk about this all the time.
Yes.
That's great. Okay. Well, you'll have the best answers for it. I just started watching this show called Veep with Julia Louis-Dreyfus, who was on Seinfeld. Anyway, she plays like the vice president, and she has, I think he's called a body guy, just like this guy who's always with her. And Buster from Arrested Development plays her body guy. And so he has this like big bag full of everything in it that she could possibly ever want at a moment's notice. And he follows her around and takes care of her every need. And there's this like one scene where she says to him, like, Gary, I need something.
Yep.
I don't know what I need, but I need something. And he's like, I'm on it. And he goes away and he comes back with like chocolate ice cream or something. And she's like, yes, this is exactly what I needed. So I imagine that when you talk about like anticipating people's needs.
I think I had a similar experience. My family is very like open to having, especially strangers, in our home. And so I grew up often with strangers becoming friends around our table. But yeah, we never really knew who it would be, but there was always something for them ready to be offered to them when they accepted invitations to come.
I'm just chuckling listening to these stories because it's sending me back to like my childhood, and specifically within the church that I grew up in. The extent of hospitality was those are the pews that you can and can't sit in. And then when it came to food, here's your little cube of white Wonder Bread and your shot glass of Welch's grape juice that you get once a month to celebrate Jesus. And as a kid, you're like, man, this grape juice is the best. It is so sweet. I want some more. And they're like, no, you can't. You can only have a thimble. So like, I mean, that's what food was, how it was kind of communicated in my childhood. But then the thing that kind of changed my perspective completely was I was in university and in a course where I had to go to a place of worship for a different religion. So I actually went to a Sikh temple for one of their services. And afterwards they're like, all right, we're all going downstairs. We're going to have a meal together. And I'm like, what? Like everyone sat down together and you just get this like lavish meal. And I'm like, what? Like you guys share a meal together as an expression of like your faith with one another? Yeah, don't you? No, I got a cube of Wonder Bread and a shot glass of Welch's juice. So I kind of like popped the lid off of something that I've been on a journey to explore with Jesus ever since.
I'm so shook that Christ's body in your church was a cube of Wonder Bread.
Didn't we both grow up Pentecostal? Wasn't I thought that was like
was no,
Pentecostal doctrine was white Wonder Bread.
Yeah, but I grew up in like
it's a wonder.
It's a wonder. And the bread of life. I see. I get it. It makes doctrinal sense. No, we used matzo crackers, broken up matzo crackers. Yeah. But I did grow up in like an inner city black Pentecostal church. So it's a little bit different from what you experienced out in Brantford.
I mean, that cube looked like matzo by the end because I would just squeeze it as a kid into like a little pellet.
Yeah. Our church likes sourdough, I think.
Oh, that's very artisanal.
Yeah, that's what it seems like.
Yeah, I think it's interesting how much of it, like the things that you guys have shared have been about like formative experiences of hospitality. What do you think? Do you think that your concept of hospitality, so Dave, you mentioned that you think about hospitality quite differently now than you did growing up. Yeah, do you think there are either like pieces of what you learned growing up, this would be for anyone, about hospitality that like continue to really shape the way that you think about it? Or would you say that your understanding of hospitality now is actually like quite different? And in what way is it different?
Well, mine changed dramatically when I got married to a Korean, because she has taught me a lot more about the categories. It's not just about food, but hospitality goes way above. And so really, I think what I learned from early days of going to running a Christmas camp was that you're anticipating the needs of international students coming away. And one of the things we fast discovered was that international students turn up at international Christmas camp without a toothbrush or without toothpaste. It's just one of those items that gets left behind every time. So it became a standard that anyone who flew, who was in the volunteer base, collected the free toothbrush and brush that came with the airline and took it to camp with them. So I think anticipating needs, and that's something that's come from me. And I understood that also in Korean hospitality, if you visit another, even the family home for a visit, they provide the shampoo, the conditioner, the soap, all those materials. You don't bring it with you.
Well, what Tony's talking about, that whole meshing two cultures together, is to me the funnest part of hospitality, where you make a space inside your celebration, whatever your tradition of celebrating is, for that other person's tradition. And you adjust and enjoy what they're doing. And you actually feel like you come away hopefully understanding them a little bit more. And like, that's when you walk away and you're like, wow, I think I'm friends with that person. And it's just because y'all shared something where you valued kind of their history. I think my development in hospitality has, my history makes, it flavors the way people experience hospitality around me. And so like, I'm a hugger, and that comes from being in Texas. So I usually try to really celebrate when someone comes, because that's how we do it in Texas. We're always so excited you made the journey to come. And yeah, it's funny watching my kids. They're like this. When I walk in the house, they'll all jump on top of me. And at times that can be quite frustrating, but it makes me so proud to see that that's a piece of my history that they've continued with. So.
Well, I would add, to just add to that, is that being married to Iris, we hosted a lot at home in our early days of ministry. She comes from the hotel industry as well. And we used to get into fights because my love language is actually acts of service. So I want to cook, but she's from her love language is quality time. So she wants to talk to people. She say, why aren't you talking to your guests? I'm serving food and preparing vast amount of it. And but so that how we do hospitality is very different compared to even our gifts and our talents.
It's a classic Mary and Martha situation right there.
Yeah, I grew up on a farm, and we often had guests in our home, especially in the summer or when there was, extra people around helping. And we were always ready, like everything would be ready for when it was time to be eating. But even still, talking about kind of that experience and even family meals, talking about that with my mom now, it's interesting to see her perspective compared to my perspective of that time. So she, as the host, I think she would have felt more that she was always just busy, always making sure that everything was there for everyone to have. And she would have wished to be able to sit and talk with more, like spend more time with the people. So there's always a bit of that conflict. I know for us, whenever we host people in our home, it's always the same thing. We are so busy hosting and being hospitable, but there's always that missing component where we feel like we hadn't had the chance to connect on a deeper level with the guests. But it's maybe they don't have that perspective at all. They're just they're happy to be where they are, experiencing what you have to offer, or having that inner glimpse of our lives, being a part of that meal or experience.
Yeah, I think that tension like definitely can come out, especially at the holidays, right? Like when you're used to cooking these big meals for everyone, and you just have a year where you think like, I just can't do it, or I want to actually be able to spend time with my family or whatever. Do you find that those tensions also come out in ministry? This idea of like, what is hospitality meant to look like in this area? What's actually the most beneficial, the most pastoral response? Sherilyn, you're grinning. Mm.
I am. This is getting a little bit ahead of the questions that you sent us, but I had I had run them by some of my former student leaders to get their perspective, because I really do think hospitality, at least in our ministry, is a team sport. Like, it requires multiple people doing multiple roles. And both of the people who responded to me, they're like memories of hospitality gone wrong, so to speak, were both instances where like either they had sort of assumed the role of host but didn't give space for other people to host alongside them, and they weren't able to be sort of welcomed by the guests in a sense. And then one of my other students was referring to a time where she was just so preoccupied with having the decorations in place and the food out and the shoes out of like the way of the door that she forgot to like welcome the people that she had invited, and was able to debrief that with the team later. But that was striking to me, that I think our whole team has been on a journey of learning how to be both welcoming and present. And I think it requires the whole team and people really playing into the gifts that they have, and some other things, but those would be the key ones that come to mind.
That reminds me of one of my early disasters, which is we had some people around for a dinner very early on again, and we started eating, and it was absolutely silent. No one said anything. And I frantically realized we actually had a room full of introverts. And there wasn't a single extrovert in the room. So it made me realize that there has to be some planning and how to make sure that interaction happens. You have to have devices to do that.
You're saying don't invite a bunch of introverts over for dinner, Tony?
I had to bring out a game board. So we actually played a game so people could talk about the game first.
Yeah.
and then get into small talk. So it is a you have to engineer things sometimes.
No, that's smart. Anticipating needs. Which game board did you pull out? Do you remember?
Actually, it's a British pub game called Shove Halfpenny.
Called what?
Shove Halfpenny. Again, it's culturally specific to me because it's from the UK and England, but it's a physical game, so you don't have to explain rules very easily.
You just shove each other?
You shove coins. You know, we shove coins up a it's like curling, but with coins.
And tiny brooms?
No brooms.
Like crokinole?
I hope so.
That does sound like crokinole. Well, Tony, we've learned that that's actually the same thing with Zoom calls. We almost, like, especially because our kids have been seeing their cousins through Zoom calls, but they'll just sit there and look at each other or show their stuff. But to get them to actually talk, we'll play a game at the beginning, whether they want to or not, just kind of to allow them to learn the communication side of things. And so trying to do hospitality over Zoom has been it's been really kind of painful at times.
Yeah.
But I think we've gotten better at it. So
how so?
Well, I mean, Sharon and I have like watched quite a few seminars to try to better understand how to connect with people emotionally over Zoom. We've hosted a number of large events and tried to understand the programs so that, like, our biggest event, we did a town hall, and we had people from Korea all the way across the world joining us because they're all friends of camp. But in order to allow them to all talk, we broke them into these small groups of five, and so that they could talk without the mics, with all the mics on and stuff, and just stuff like that. That it wasn't even in our wheelhouse when in March, and we wanted to see people come together in a positive way, and so we've kind of pushed into this technology. Because I mean, our camp, we kind of discourage technology, and so to try to harness it for the good has been a bit of a challenge, but it's been really interesting.
Yeah, and I think, like, it's one thing to try and harness the power of technology for, I don't know, promotional sake, or like to try and do some sort of outreach or keep people updated on what's going on. And I think, like, I struggled with that anyway before COVID. And I'm sure, like, you know, if you're in a place where you're discouraging the constant use of technology, you're just trying to get people off their devices, you know, we may not even be super fluent in that. But then to expand our use of technology into the realm of hospitality and actually try and connect with people and anticipate their needs online and over a screen and through all of these various levels of barrier. I mean, what has that experience been like for you guys this year?
Well, we've looked at the events that we would normally be having or normally be planning in January, like right now. And one of those things would be like a coffee house, a talent show, basically, that we'd have our staff and alumni. It's just a fun event. We're not asking them for anything, just to show up and enjoy their community. And so we're still planning to do that. But normally, what are the two big components of that event? Well, obviously, food and snacks, right? Mm-hmm. And then time to chat and hang out afterwards. The amount of time that is spent is at least equal to the amount of time where, like, people are up on the stage. So how do we actually still nurture that? Because clearly we don't want to actually remove that.
Right.
And so we'll still have an event, but we're going to figure out, well, how do we get these kids a fun snack? Or, like, how is that actually feasible? How are we going to deliver all these little parcels? So it's still something we want to do, but it's a component that has to be figured out.
Yeah, I think what we really learned is we've tried to figure out what people connect with in our ministry, in camp as a whole, and tried to say, how do we meet that need through technology? And say, don't meet every need, don't try to do everything, but let them walk away feeling like, you know what, that was a camp experience. And so I think that's been really positive for us so far.
what you've shared raises the question I've been wrestling with a while, because most of the Zoom things are events, not community. And how can we actually create community from an event? Because normally I've been wrestling with this is how, and I actually talked with some TAs at the university about it, some Christian TAs, and one of them shared how he actually was doing a tutoring session and realized that the students were alone and by themselves in this COVID season. So he said, would you like just to, the tutoring's finished. Now, if you want to hang on in this Zoom room for another hour just to hang and chat, you're very welcome. So I think it's not just the event, it's the time after the event. How can we create that time afterwards? Because that's part of hospitality. Is that our experience is that we can't get people to go home after an event. Yeah. And that's the hospitality moment.
Yeah.
So how do we do that? I think it's trying to find a way of using Zoom to create community.
I mean, I wonder if games are a part of that. Like, that actually is a good and right place for games in our ministry. Because I know, like, the church I go to, we've done all our services over Zoom. And they've done that similar thing. Like, okay, after the service, like, anyone wants to stick around and chat, let's do that. But then you still have, like, 16, 17 screens of people trying to talk. And, like, it's just so jarring and disorienting that it induces more stress and anxiety than it does actually like, oh, I want to stay here and connect with people. But when you have something that's actually channeling people's attention and focus, and there's like this, you know, element of fun and appreciation for the people you're actually having fun with, I think that helps people stick around and have some vehicle for relating to one another that's not the no holds barred, everyone unmuted and talking over each other pandemonium, which for me sounds more like weeping and gnashing of teeth than it does a joyous reunion.
Well, for our big meeting, we did polls during the meeting where everybody got to engage in a question, and then we moved the people into the chat room. And what I found was funny is we, instead of having just a face on the screen, we had pictures. So people were actually just laughing and blowing up, private chatting each other during, instead of feeling like they needed to look at the presenter, they were okay with listening and like just seeing the pictures, but chatting with their friends. And it was just so much fun to see all these people like having a good time, chatting with each other, connecting. And like, because they were so far away from each other and they just hadn't connected in a long time, the people were just having such a good time kind of exercising their fingers during our presentation. And I'm sure they heard most of it, but they definitely were laughing and rolling around on in their phone calls and stuff like that, because, or in their chat room and stuff. And then afterwards, when we broke them into these little groups, it was just amazing. Like we gave them 15 minutes each time or something like that, and people didn't want to leave. And I think Sharon was on the call until like an hour and a half afterwards, just talking with people. And yeah, I mean, it can happen.
To be able to facilitate those new things and think about what people are missing. That's definitely what we've been working on this season.
Yeah. Yeah, because we love doing it in person. I mean, like the hospitality, feeding people, that is our sweet spot. But we've had our biggest strength taken away, and we've tried to work on developing all those little strengths that people still really value in what we do.
Yeah, that whole question of like, what even is community in a season where you can't physically be with people in the way that you used to be able to be with them is just like a real trip. It's kind of a real knock to our organization, I feel like. And like early on in the pandemic, I think I talked to Linda or someone about like, well, what is it going to look like now for us to continue to like be about Jesus and bringing Jesus to kids at camp and students on campus and youth in high schools when we can't actually rely on one of the structures that we I think, rely on the most, which is making space, building community, all of these terms that we use to talk about just being physically present with people. Like that is, I would say, like 90% of all of our ministries is just being physically present with people. But like, you know, the good news is still good news, and Jesus still wants to transform people. And when it feels like our legs have been cut out from under us, what place does hospitality still serve in that? And what does it look like? Particularly, what does it look like to see that be sustained? So I think, like, I appreciate you guys talking about the time and space after an event online and getting people to interact that way. And I'll be honest and say that because in the Atlantic, we've been really fortunate to have pretty lax restrictions for most of the time. We actually have been able to meet in person primarily, limited to 10 people at a time or whatever. And then sometimes the restrictions go back and forth and you have to get creative about it. But I think particularly in places where you just haven't ever really been able to gather with people in person, how do you deal with the Zoom fatigue and the people not wanting to do another thing online? And like, where does that leave the community as a sustained presence when it's not a physical presence? Does that make sense?
Well, I think some of it's adjusting to scale. Like, you're not going to have 100 people, or for us, it's 100, 200 people.
Yeah.
You're going to have to celebrate 5 people getting together. It's the fact that we're reaching, to me, as people who value hospitality and want to use that as a means to connect with people, it's the fact that we're reaching out and asking them to join us on a phone call or texting them to ask how they're doing or using Zoom. It's using all the different mediums we can to show people that we still really value them.
And that's why we've implemented so many, crazy ideas. Like last night and then this morning, Neil and I delivered to 8 families packages of food, and with the plans to have some crazy Facebook Live class on how to deal with the turnips that I just gave them, because I know I never buy turnips. What are you gonna do with a pound of turnips? But it was free, and I think that they will appreciate it. But we've never integrated that into our ministry plans.
Yeah. And it wasn't just turnips. Right. That was just an element.
No, that was just the oddball in the package. But having to be creative, we all enjoy doing that, and that's part of hospitality, but we're definitely getting to stretch our ideas a little bit out of our comfort zones.
Yeah. So would you say that, I when I see everyone on the screen here, I can see the creativity that each of you brings to your hospitality game in the best of seasons when we can be with people. Would you say that right now, really, it's just a pivoting of that creativity? So it might not be the 7 courses that you might want to make for someone who's going to come over and you want to really wow them, but it might be you're putting that creative energy into the 7 ways you're going to get someone to connect with someone through a Zoom meeting or the means we have available to us.
I was just going to say, I think that's what we have been learning here in the ISM community in Ottawa. Thanksgiving comes to mind as a good example of those adjustments. Last year, we had almost 40 people sitting at tables crammed into my house. and it was a real party. We had students and alumni, invited some neighbors and colleagues, and it was one of the highlights of my whole year. And I was hoping to replicate and grow that this year. And all through the early days of COVID, sometimes I would wake up in the middle of the night and wonder, what will we do for Thanksgiving? and as it got closer, I caught wind of colleagues out west who were going to like make and deliver food to like close to 50 students. And I was thinking, yes, that's what we'll do. And we got closer to the time and realized we actually, in our current context here, don't have the infrastructure to pull that off. And we realized that I think if we could have done it, but we would have been tired. We would have not been like joyful to welcome our friends to like a community Zoom call at the end of it. And we wouldn't have a whole lot, I think, to show for it other than we fed our friends and maybe their friends' friends. And so we pivoted kind of at the last minute to host what we called Tiny Thanksgivings in my backyard. And we were allowed to gather up to like 5 or 6 people. And so we just had a rotation of people who signed up for different slots and they came and ate apple pie and brought desserts to share over the whole Thanksgiving weekend. And we had 2 Zoom calls to sort of accommodate for friends who were living out of the city or who weren't comfortable to come. We also have a lot of students like living internationally right now, either who've reconnected with our community or who have traveled to see family and aren't able to come back to study here. And so I think that sort of helped us capture all the people who were important to us. And it let us really love them well, because we decided to do something for us, like within our means, and it looked very simple, but it was a really joyful weekend. And so I think we're glad to be learning that even the small things are actually very meaningful. And there's been tremendous fruit from that weekend.
That's really cool. That's such a good idea.
I love the idea of Tiny Thanksgivings.
I think
yes. Of quail.
Yeah.
Just tuck that away for next year.
Yeah.
But the intimacy of the smaller 5 is brings a different measure, because in one sense hospitality has 2 functions, one of which is a service project and the other which is a communal building, and one is about intimacy, the other is about building trust towards intimacy. So maybe this season is the one where we're learning the smaller scale to build the smaller communities and to build the trust deepen the trust that we already have. So I'm excited by small scale. We've been doing the same thing as Sherilyn, but we've been doing it in the snow in our backyard, in temperatures below 0. So it's so I actually have now 3 charcoal barbecues. We stand around, but at the correct 2 meters apart.
Yeah.
No, you can cook something over your charcoal barbecue and try and stay warm for an hour or so. But it's still outside is different from being inside. So there's a different level of hospitality, but it's still hospitality.
Yeah, and shouting at people from 2 meters away is different from being able to speak freely. Yeah.
That was part 1 of our 2-parter on hospitality. Come back on Thursday to hear the rest of our conversation with Tony, Sherilyn, Sharon, and Neil.
And just a reminder, if you want to take part in this podcast, we have a way you can get involved. So if you have a name that is often mispronounced within university circles, we'd love to know the right way of pronouncing it. So if you could send an audio recording of yourself under 20 seconds to dstone@ivcf.ca, we will release a special Sanjana Needs a Friend podcast that has you and everyone else who sends their name in pronouncing their names correctly. So that's a 20-second clip. Anything beyond that, we probably won't include it because it'll just be too long. But send that to dstone@ivcf.ca. Thanks for joining us.
See you later, everyone.